Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine, if you will, looking up at the night sky on a completely clear, moonless night. You see this single point of light, and it looks tiny, right? It's just shimmering, seemingly completely self-contained.
Right, just a speck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then you look at that exact same point through a really powerful telescope, and you realize it is not a single star at all. It is an entire galaxy. I mean, it's this massive, swirling, infinitely complex system of worlds, all just condensed into a single speck of light from our, you know, our limited vantage point on Earth.
That is, that's actually a brilliant way to frame what we're doing today.
Well, today, we are looking through that telescope. We are setting out on a journey into a textual galaxy that appears, at first glance anyway, to be incredibly brief. I mean, it is short enough to read in a single sitting, yet it contains the blueprint for the entire cosmos, and even more profoundly, the architectural blueprint for your own mind and body.
It's a profound analogy, and it establishes exactly the right mindset to bring to this material. The text we're immersing ourselves in today requires that level of patience, you know, that willingness to look deeper and a profound sense of reverence.
Yeah.
This is not a document you just skim for quick information. It is a text you sit with, perhaps for a lifetime, just allowing its layers to slowly reveal themselves.
So our mission in this deep dive is to explore a highly sacred canonical text from the Tibetan Buddhist Kangyur, which is the collection of the Buddha's translated words. The text is called Equal to the Sky, the Glorious King of Tantras.
A magnificent title.
It really is. In its catalog designation, it is known as TO 386, and we have the tremendous privilege of exploring this text through a recent English translation provided by the 84,000 Project.
Yes, their work is just invaluable.
For those listening who might not be familiar, 84,000 is an extraordinary global initiative. They are dedicated to translating the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages and making them freely available. It is a monumental, multi-generational undertaking of, well, just preserving human wisdom.
And the specific text they have brought into English for us here, Equal to the Sky, is a true marvel of spiritual literature. To give you some historical grounding before we really enter its philosophy, this text was translated into Tibetan back in the late 11th century.
Wow, so quite a long time ago.
Very long. The translation was a collaborative, highly rigorous effort between the renowned Tibetan translator Drokmi Lhotsawa Shikya Yeshe and the great Indian scholar or Patita Gayudhara.
So it was a cross-cultural collaboration right from the start.
Exactly. When we hold the concepts of this text in our minds, we are not just analyzing abstract theory. We are connecting with an unbroken, living lineage of realization that stretches back well over a millennium. These two translators were essentially bridging the profound esoteric traditions of India and laying the groundwork for the later blossoming of the Sakya tradition in Tibet.
Now, in terms of its place in the canon, I understand it belongs to a specific cluster of teachings known as the Raleigh Tantras.
Yes, the Raleigh Tantra.
And within that set, it's classified as an awakened mind tantra. But what makes it so fascinating to scholars and practitioners alike is that while it formally belongs to the Kakasavara system of Yogini Tantras, it acts like this grand synthesis.
It really does. It weaves things together.
Right. It heavily weaves in major themes from other profound esoteric systems, particularly the Kalachakra and the Hivajra Tantras.
To understand why it weaves these diverse threads together, we really have to look at the text's title, Equal to the Sky. In Sanskrit, this is the Kasama Tantra. This title is actually a hook into a vast mythic tradition.
A hook in what way?
Well, the Kakrasavara Tantra, which is a central pillar of Tibetan Buddhist practice, is alternatively known as the Lagusavara, which translates roughly to the light or condensed version.
Which naturally raises the question, condensed from what?
Exactly. Tradition holds that it is a condensation of a staggering mythic source text consisting of 100,000 verses.
100,000, that's massive.
Unimaginably massive. And this original text is said to have never been fully transmitted to our ordinary human realm because humans simply do not have the capacity or even the lifespan to hold it. And the title of that unimaginably vast mythic text is the Kasama Tantra.
So by taking on the exact same name, this incredibly short text we're looking at today is essentially announcing itself with immense authority.
That's precisely it.
It's saying, you know, I am the distillation. I am the key to the whole system. I look at it as holding a cosmic executive summary. It's a text so overwhelmingly dense that every single stanza, every single line contains worlds upon worlds of meaning.
Every word is load-bearing.
Load-bearing, I love that. Because it is so dense, we are going to take our time today. We're going to unpack this together slowly and thoughtfully, giving you the time and space to let these concepts resonate within your own experience. We are going to intentionally slow down our usual pace, step out of the rush of the modern day, and approach this as a true Dharma teaching.
That pacing is essential. Mm-hmm. When dealing with the Yogini Tantras, we are not merely talking about philosophical cosmology. We are talking about the subtle architecture of your own being.
We're talking about our own bodies, basically.
Yeah, your own deep physiology. This text is primarily concerned with what is called the completion stage of tantric practice. This is the stage of advanced yogic practice where the practitioner works directly with the inner physiology, what we will come to know as the subtle winds, channels, and drops.
But before we can even touch upon the mechanics of how this works, the text sets a very specific cosmic stage.
It does. A very unique setting.
Right. Before we understand what is being taught, we must understand where the teaching is taking place and who is receiving it. Let's look at the very opening of the text, the preamble that follows the traditional homage.
Go ahead.
It reads, "Thus did I hear at one time. The Blessed One was dwelling in the Bhaga of the Vajra Queen, the awakened body, speech, and mind of all thus gone ones."
Let us pause and truly absorb that opening, because it signals an immediate radical departure from the conventional sutra teachings many people might be familiar with.
How so?
Well, in the foundational sutras, the Buddha is typically described as dwelling in a historical, physical location, like Vulture Peak Mountain or the Jada Grove in Shravasti. There is a geographical reality to it. You could point to it on a map.
Right, like an actual hillside in India.
Exactly. But here, the setting is completely outside of ordinary time and space. Mm-hmm. The Blessed One, the awakened teacher, is dwelling in the Bhaga of the Vajra Queen.
Now, the word Bhaga is a term that often gets translated as womb or source or the female generative organ. But in this context, it feels heavily layered with symbolic meaning. It is clearly not a physical place on a map.
No, it is not anatomical at all. It is ontological. It refers to the nature of reality itself.
The nature of reality.
Yes. The Bhaga represents the ultimate source of awakened reality, the womb of emptiness from which all phenomena arise and into which all phenomena eventually dissolve. Notice how the text explicitly defines this space in the very same breath. It calls it the awakened body, speech, and mind of all thus gone ones.
And the thus gone ones are the Buddhas.
Correct. So the setting of this teaching is the fundamental pure nature of reality. It is the unconditioned space of enlightened awareness. The teaching does not just come from an awakened state. It is taking place entirely within the awakened state.
That shifts the listener's perspective immediately. If you're going to receive this teaching, you have to mentally step out of your ordinary, solid historical framework and enter into this limitless, unconditioned space.
You have to leave conventional reality at the door.
Yeah. And once we are in that space, we meet the audience. The text says, "At that time, present among the assembly were the sky-dwelling, earth-dwelling, and subterranean Kekinis."
This brings us to a crucial technical term that we really must define clearly and carefully, the Ekini.
Right, because that word carries a lot of baggage.
It does. In Tibetan, the word is mhagro, which translates literally as sky-goer, or one who moves in space. Now, in popular or outer mythology, Kekinis are often depicted as fierce, ethereal, or semi-divine female beings who fly through the air.
Like magical sky fairies or spirits.
Exactly, that's the outer conception. But in the context of the highest yoga tantras, such as the text we are studying today, the Kekini takes on a profoundly internal meaning.
They aren't just spirits floating in the clouds observing the Buddha.
Far from it. The Kekini represents the dynamic flow of energy within your own body. They are personifications of the practitioner's physical and subtle body, and they represent distinct stages of the completion stage yogic practices.
So when the text talks about them as an audience,
when the Buddha addresses the sky-dwelling, earth-dwelling, and subterranean Ekinis, he is actually mapping out the energetic anatomy of the human being. The entire discourse is a mirror reflecting our own innermost reality back to us.
Before the text dives into that deep internal anatomy, though, there is a profound warning and an instruction to the listener. In verse 3, the Buddha says, "With faith, compassion, and a one-pointed mind, fix your body and your speech, set your mind toward others' benefit. Endeavoring toward fearless yogic discipline, with zeal for the profound path, listen well."
That is a crucial prerequisite.
I want to pause here and ask you about this because we are about to dive into incredibly advanced esoteric physiology, winds, channels, drops, the very mechanics of enlightenment. Why must immense compassion, a mindset toward others' benefit, and a fearless yogic discipline be established right at the threshold? I mean, why can't we just learn the mechanics and apply them?
That's a very modern way of thinking. Just give me the user manual, right? But in the Buddhist tantric tradition, the technology of the subtle body is recognized as incredibly powerful.
Powerful in a transformative sense.
Powerful in a fundamentally disruptive sense. Working with these inner energies can rapidly strip away ordinary perception and dismantle the ego structure. If a practitioner engages in these methods without a foundational bedrock of bodhicitta, which is the genuine altruistic intention to attain awakening solely for the benefit of all sentient beings, the practice becomes deeply problematic.
Problematic in terms of psychological safety.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Without the anchor of compassion, the massive amplification of energy that occurs in tantric practice simply inflates the ego. It becomes a pursuit of personal power, you know, a form of spiritual materialism.
So you just end up with a highly energized, powerful ego, which is the exact opposite of the goal.
Precisely. The instruction to set your mind toward others' benefit is the ultimate safety mechanism. It ensures that the immense power generated by these yogic disciplines flows outwardly toward liberation and service, rather than turning inward to further entrench the practitioner in cyclic existence or saisara.
And it also mentions fearless yogic discipline.
Yes. Furthermore, it requires a fearless yogic discipline because to look directly into the ultimate nature of your own mind and to transmute your deepest, most primal, vital energies requires you to let go of every solid concept you hold about who you think you are.
That sounds terrifying, honestly.
It is. You have to face the sheer, unconditioned vastness of your own mind, and that terrifies the ordinary ego. Compassion is what gives you the courage to face that vastness without retreating into fear.
So compassion is the anchor that keeps you grounded when the winds of the path begin to blow. That takes us perfectly into the second section of the text, where we move from this cosmic audience into the practitioner's inner landscape.
To the first akini.
Right. We begin with the first of the three akinis, the sky-dwelling gokini, who governs the movement of our very life force.
The text declares in verse 4, sky-dweller is the winds of the upper gate. When we use the term winds, we are translating the Sanskrit word prak, or the Tibetan word rulung.
Right. Ruling.
It is vital to understand that we are not merely talking about the gross physical air moving in and out of your lungs, although the physical breath is the outermost manifestation of it.
So it's not just respiration.
No, we are talking about the subtle energetic currents that serve as the fundamental support for all physical movement and all mental activity.
The text brings in an astonishing level of detail here, actually, drawing heavily from Kalachakra astrology to map the human body directly to the cosmos. It notes that a healthy human being takes exactly 21,600 breaths in a 24-hour period.
Which is remarkably accurate.
It is. And this physical rhythm maps perfectly onto the 21,600 subtle winds circulating within the body's subtle channels. The microcosm is literally the macrocosm. Every breath you take is synchronized with the turning of the celestial wheel. Just think about that for a second. In the 11th century, they were mapping the exact number of human breaths to celestial movements. That level of somatic awareness is staggering.
It is a breathtaking vision of interconnectedness. The text breaks this down with meticulous mathematical precision in verses 8 through 10. It divides the physical wind into four circulatory movements, either pure or defiled, making eight.
Okay, so eight movements.
Yes, and it maps these to 8 3-hour periods in a day, which are then divided into 16 circulations. Each circulation takes 2 hours. Within each hour, there are 2 dantas, which is a traditional Indian measure of time.
This sounds almost like a hyper-detailed technical manual.
It does. So there are 64 dantas of wind, 32 hours, ultimately dividing down into those 21,600 breaths.
I have to ask, why such intense mathematical precision? I mean, why go to all this trouble to divide hours and dantas?
Because Tantra is treated as a rigorous science of the mind and body. This precision grounds the practitioner in reality. It takes the abstract, often fuzzy idea of spiritual energy and anchors it to the rhythmic, undeniable reality of time passing and breath moving.
It makes it tangible.
Exactly. It proves that awakening is not some vague mystical event that happens to you by chance. It is intricately, mechanically tied to the very fabric of how you breathe, how time flows through you, and how your subtle body is constructed.
So then the text categorizes these winds into 3 profound types. the physical wind, the cognitive wind, and the wisdom wind. Let's really explore these because this is where the philosophy truly meets the meditation cushion.
The physical wind, as we discussed, is the energetic support for our bodily functions.
Right. But the cognitive wind, this is where it gets fascinating, is described as the mount or the steed of the mind.
Let me recite the specific verses concerning this, because the poetry here is as profound as the physiology. In verse 11, the text states, "The wise should take hold of the mount of the mind, the steed of the mind concepts of grasper and grasped. When these two grasper and grasps have ceased, the winds come to rest at the center."
The steed of the mind. Wait, let me make sure I understand this clearly. Are you saying that my physical breath, or at least the subtle energy driving my breath, is literally attached to my thoughts, like that they ride on each other?
Precisely. In the ordinary, unawakened state, the mind and the wind are completely inseparable. Think of a rider on a horse. The mind is the rider and the wind is the horse.
Okay.
If your subtle winds are agitated and moving outward through your sensory channels, your mind is agitated, chasing after objects. You cannot calm a frantic mind without calming the underlying winds, and you cannot direct the winds without directing the mind.
That explains so much about anxiety, honestly. Like when you're anxious, your breathing gets shallow and fast.
Because the horse is spooked, so to speak. The cognitive wind is driven entirely by dualism, what the text calls the concepts of the grasper and the grasped. The grasper is the subjective ego, the I that wants or rejects. The grasped is the objective world, the things we desire or fear.
To ground this in everyday experience, when you are, say, scrolling on your phone, desperately looking for the next hit of dopamine or getting angry at a news headline, that is your karmic wind being severely agitated by the grasper, your ego wanting something external, your mind is galloping outward on that steed.
Yes. And when a practitioner engages in the completion stage yoga, their primary task is to guide these scattered dualistic winds away from the outer senses and draw them into the central channel of the subtle body.
Into the center.
The text tells us that when the winds enter this central channel, the concepts of grasper and grasp naturally cease. The horse stops running outward. And when the winds come to rest at the center, the text says, by itself, this is the wind of Vajra wisdom.
That transmutation is clearly the heart of the tantric path. But I have to push back on a point here, or rather explore a seeming paradox that arises a few verses later.
Please do.
In verse 16, the text says, due to the cataracts of ignorance, the jewel of the mind has become stained. This is the conceptual wind. This wind is itself the path.
Ah, yes. Verse 16.
I find this profoundly challenging. In classical foundational Buddhism, ignorance avidya is the root cause of all suffering. It is the very thing we are trying to eradicate. The conceptual wind, as we just established, is what keeps us trapped in cyclic existence, galloping after illusions.
That's the conventional view, yes.
So how can the text boldly declare that the very thing staining our mind, the conceptual wind of ignorance, is itself the path? I mean, how can the poison possibly be the medicine?
You have just highlighted the defining characteristic of the Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. It operates on the principle of spiritual alchemy. In the foundational vehicles, you treat negative emotions, conceptual thoughts, and ignorance as obstacles to be avoided, suppressed, or renounced.
All right, if you find a poisonous plant in your garden, you pull it out by the roots and throw it away.
Exactly. But the tantric approach recognizes the deeper truth. The fundamental nature of all phenomena, even our darkest ignorance and heaviest conceptual thoughts, is empty and luminous. They have no solid, independent existence.
So you don't throw the poison away. You use it.
Think of a skilled alchemist or a highly trained physician. They know how to take a deadly poison and, through a very specific, careful process, transmute it into a life-saving medicine. The conceptual wind, the energetic manifestation of our dualistic thinking, our anger, our grasping, is incredibly powerful. It has immense momentum and heat.
It does. Anger is so much energy.
If you try to simply suppress it, you are going to war with your own life force. You will exhaust yourself. Instead, the tantric practitioner uses yogic methods to harness that exact same wind. By drawing that conceptual, ordinary karmic wind into the central channel, its dualistic, harmful nature dissolves. But its sheer energetic power is retained and liberated as the non-dual Vajra wisdom wind. You do not destroy the wind. You realize its true, unstained nature. The obstacle itself becomes the method of liberation.
That is a staggering shift in perspective for a practitioner. It means that even our deepest neuroses, our most turbulent thoughts, and our heaviest emotional burdens are not fundamentally separate from enlightenment. They are just the wisdom winds blowing in the wrong direction, moving through the wrong channels.
Moving through the wrong channels, exactly.
And to change that direction, the winds need roads to travel on. We need to understand the map of the body, mm-hmm. which transitions our focus from the sky-dwelling wind to the landscape through which it moves, which is the domain of the second Akini, the earth-dwelling Akini.
Verse 4 tells us, earth-dweller is the drops of the middle gate. As the text elaborates in the following section, this earth-dwelling Akini represents the intricate, luminous network of channels within the subtle body.
The channels.
The term used here is Natan in Sanskrit, or Vritsa in Tibetan. For the sake of clarity, we will refer to them simply as the subtle channels.
The text mentions an almost unfathomable number 72,000 channels within the human body. Again, to be absolutely clear for the listener, we are not talking about physical veins, arteries, or nerves that a surgeon could see with a scalpel.
No, not at all.
We are talking about pathways of subtle energy. And out of these 72,000, there are three primary ones that the yogi works with: the right channel, the left channel, and the central channel.
The right and left channels run parallel to the spine. They are the standard pathways for those ordinary, dualistic, karmic winds we just discussed. They carry the energy of the solar and the lunar, the masculine and the feminine, the grasper and the grass.
They carry all that duality?
Yes. But at certain critical points along the spine, which we often refer to as chakras or energy centers, these right and left channels actually loop around the central channel, creating tight constrictions.
The text refers to these constrictions beautifully. It calls them channel knots. And in verse 26, it says, these knots are similar to letters. These are known as the primordial sound.
It is a powerful somatic image. Think of the knots in our subtle body as the physical and energetic locations where our past karma, our deep emotional habituations, and our conceptual blockages are tightly tied up.
Like somatic tension, like when we carry trauma in our gut or our chest.
Exactly like that. But on a subtle energetic level, when the winds try to flow freely, they hit these knots, causing turbulence and distress. The practitioner's task is to untie these knots, allowing the trapped winds to finally enter the central channel.
And how exactly does one untie a knot made of subtle energy? I mean, you can't just reach in there with your fingers. This is where the earth-dwelling Pokhani introduces one of the most famous and profound practices in Tibetan Buddhism, the practice of inner heat, or Kanchali in Sanskrit, known widely by its Tibetan name, Gitmo.
Yes, Kentmo.
The text goes into remarkable detail here, subdividing this practice into highly specific categories. In verse 20, it lists the natural inner heat, the inner heat of union, and the naked inner heat.
And it goes even further.
Right. It breaks those down even further into 12 aspects and 48 branches. It even gives microscopic measurements to aid the visualization. It speaks of the point where the three main channels unite at the navel as being the size of a single mustard seed.
A single mustard seed.
Yeah. And it measures the relative widths of the channels by comparing them to the tips of 120 hairs versus the tips of 32 hairs.
We see here the absolute union of the vast cosmos and the microscopic body. The practitioner's attention is drawn deeply inward, away from the external world, to a focal point the size of a mustard seed, deep within the body, typically located at the navel chakra.
And what happens at that point?
It is at this infinitesimally small, hyper-focused point that the inner fire of Kutmo is ignited.
Now, I want to bring in a modern analogy here to try and understand the texture of this heat, because the text makes a very stern distinction that is vital for anyone trying to understand this psychologically.
It does make a sharp distinction.
In verse 24, the text warns, mere fierce fire produced from elsewhere is the antithesis of this subtle inner heat. When I read that, I immediately thought of how we experience heat or intensity in our ordinary worldly lives.
What did you picture?
Well, ordinary fierce fire feels like destructive anger or chronic unbridled stress. It is the adrenaline rush of conflict. When you are furious, you literally feel physically hot. You know, your face flushes.
You're burning up.
Right. But that kind of heat is a forest fire. It consumes its fuel rapidly. It destroys everything in its path, and eventually it leaves you burned out, exhausted, and covered in ash. It is chaotic and uncontrolled.
That is a very apt description of karmic fire.
But Cassie, this subtle inner heat the earth-dwelling Akini represents must be completely different. It cannot be a forest fire. I picture it more like a perfectly calibrated industrial laser, or like the steady blue pilot light of a furnace.
A pilot light. That's good.
It is concentrated, It is intensely powerful, but it is completely controlled. It doesn't destroy the practitioner, it purifies them. And fundamentally, instead of leading to burnout, it leads to immense physical and mental bliss.
The reason it functions like a laser rather than a forest fire comes down to where the winds are located. Ordinary anger or stress, the forest fire, is driven by the karmic winds moving violently through the outer right and left channels.
The channels of duality.
Exactly. It is a state of severe dualistic friction, literally rubbing your nervous system raw. It depletes the body's vital essence. The inner heat of Dinatamo, however, is ignited only when the winds begin to withdraw from those outer channels and enter the central channel. It is a wisdom fire.
So it's not based on friction?
No, it's based on unity. As this perfectly calibrated pilot light flares up from the mustard seed-sized point at the navel, it travels smoothly upward through the central channel. As it rises, the heat of this laser-like awareness begins to gently but firmly untie those channel knots we discussed earlier.
It's dissolving them.
Yes. It burns away the conceptual obscurations, the primordial sound of dualism locked in those knots. And as it does, it releases the trapped energy, bringing about a state of profound, non-conceptual joy and clarity. It is a regenerative heat.
So the winds are centered. And the inner fire is burning upward through the central channel, untying the knots. But heat alone isn't the final goal. That heat has to interact with something at the crown of the head to produce awakening. What is that fire actually melting?
That question brings us to the final member of our triad, the subterranean Pakatini. Verse 5 states, subterranean dweller is the lower gate of Shukra. This introduces the domain of the drops, or the vital essences of the subtle body.
The drops. The text maps this out so vividly. When the inner fire, the great Tammo, blazes upward through the central channel, it eventually reaches the crown of the head. And resting at the crown chakra is what is known as the white drop.
The pure white essence.
The text describes it in verse 34 as having attributes similar to snow. And in verse 35, it says it is like a jasmine-colored gem, glossy white and resplendent. It takes the visual form of the Sanskrit syllable, han.
As the pure heat of the wisdom fire touches this snow-like white drop at the crown, the drop begins to melt. And as this melted essence descends down through the chakras within the central channel, it generates progressively deeper, more pervasive states of innate, unconditioned bliss.
And it meets another drop, doesn't it?
Yes. At the same time, there is a red drop, naturally clear, which resides at the navel. The interplay, the union of this descending white drop of method and the ascending red drop of wisdom within the central channel, represents the absolute pinnacle of the completion stage practice.
The text links these subtle drops directly to the concept of the awakening mind, or bodhicitta. Now, usually when we hear the word bodhicitta in foundational Mahayana teachings, we think of the compassionate intention to attain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings.
An attitude of mind, essentially.
Right. But here, the text speaks of a physiological or subtle physical bodhicitta. It describes three types. The suchness mind, which is inexpressible. The self-aware mind, which is conditioned like a crystal reflecting light. And the physical awakening mind, which it compares to the sense of sandalwood and camphor.
This is where the profound integration of mind and body in highest yoga tantra becomes entirely explicit. The altruistic intention, the mind of awakening, is not merely a passing abstract thought. It has a physical energetic correlate in the body. The drops literally are the physical awakening mind.
They are the physical substance of enlightenment.
Yes. But the text makes a critical division here between what is conventional and what is ultimate. Listen closely to verses 32 and 33. What moves by way of karmic winds and karmic fires is conventional awakening mind. What moves by way of wisdom winds and wisdom fires is the ultimate awakening mind.
And then, driving the point home in verses 34 and 35, it describes the experience of this ultimate drop. Not moving through the karmic winds, not burning through the karmic fires, its attributes are similar to snow. It arises as the body of great bliss. This is the ultimate awakening mind.
It arises as the body of great bliss.
Let's unpack the difference between the conventional drops moving by karmic wind and the ultimate drops moving by wisdom wind.
Mm-hmm.
How does this relate to our everyday suffering?
In our ordinary unawakened existence, our vital essences, our physical and energetic drops, are constantly being stirred up, agitated, and ultimately depleted by karmic winds and fires.
So when we get stressed out,
Exactly. When we experience strong attachment, sharp aversion, or deep ignorance, these winds blow violently through the side channels, causing our vital energy to leak out. This continuous leakage of our vital energy is the very engine of cyclic existence.
That's a profound way to look at it, a continuous leakage.
It is what keeps us trapped in a state of perpetual dissatisfaction, aging, and eventual death. Mm-hmm. We are quite literally leaking our life force away by chasing after illusions.
Wow.
Through the supreme yogic mastery of the three akinis, mastering the winds, blazing the inner heat through the central channel, and stabilizing the drops, the practitioner actively halts this karmic leakage.
They seal the leaks.
The drops no longer move according to the chaotic winds of karma. They move solely according to wisdom. When this stability is achieved, the text says it arises as the body of great bliss. The practitioner realizes the indestructible awakened state within their own living body.
It is a stunning, comprehensive architectural map of human potential. We have moved from the sky-dwelling wind through the earth-dwelling channels down to the subterranean drops, essentially transmuting every single layer of our being.
Every layer, yes.
But right after mapping this profound inner alchemy, the text takes a sudden shift. It moves its focus from what is happening in the subtle body to how a practitioner is supposed to read and interpret the very words describing it. It moves into the realm of tantric hermeneutics, you know, the theory of interpretation.
It is a necessary shift because the language of Tantra is densely coded, often referred to as twilight language. If you read it literally, you will be deeply misled and, as we discussed earlier, potentially harmed.
Because you might try to physically act out things that are meant energetically.
Precisely. In verse 40, the text introduces a sixfold system for interpreting tantric texts. This system is a hallmark of advanced Buddhist textual study.
Let's go through those six modes.
Drawing on the gloss provided by the great 12th century master Senam Tsemo in the translation's notes, these six modes are the symbolic or implicit syllable, the explicit characteristic, the special contextual meaning, the general purpose, the hidden purpose, and finally, the ultimate intent.
When I try to wrap my head around this sixfold system, I keep coming back to an analogy of a musician learning a deeply complex piece of music, say, a jazz composition or a classical symphony.
How so?
Well, if you hand the sheet music to a beginner, they look at the explicit characteristics. They read the literal notes on the page. Play a C here, play a G there. That is the explicit meaning. It's necessary, but it's completely superficial.
It's just the surface data.
Right. Then you have a more advanced student who understands music theory. They look at those same notes and understand the general purpose and the contextual meaning. They see that these notes form a specific chord progression, that they're creating a specific tension and release. They understand the underlying grammar of the music.
They see the structure.
Yes. But then you have the master. The master knows the notes. They know the theory. But they also know the hidden purpose, the emotional landscape the composer was trying to navigate. And ultimately, when the master closes their eyes and actually plays the music in a room full of people, transcending the sheet music entirely and dissolving into the pure experience of the sound, that is the ultimate intent.
That is a beautiful way to understand it.
The ultimate intent cannot be found in ink on a page. It is born of non-conceptual awareness in the moment of performance.
Building on that, if a beginner tries to play the ultimate intent without understanding the explicit notes, it sounds like chaos. And if a scholar only studies the notes without ever playing the instrument, it remains dead ink. To read a tantra is to read the sheet music of awakening.
That's a great phrase, the sheet music of awakening.
Verse 41 explicitly supports your analogy regarding non-conceptual awareness. Like a jewel and like a symbol, the varieties of ultimate phenomena arise on the basis of non-conceptual awareness. The music must be played in the silence of non-conceptual awareness.
So these modes train you to look deeper.
The six modes teach the practitioner not to get stuck on the surface. When the text says bhaga, the explicit meaning might be anatomical. The hidden meaning might refer to a specific energetic center in the subtle body. But the ultimate intent is the direct, unmediated realization of emptiness and great bliss. If you only read the literal notes, you are not hearing the symphony.
And this demand for a deeper, more sophisticated reading is reflected in how the text categorizes these spiritual paths themselves. It lays out a hierarchy of tantric practice.
It does.
In verses 47 and 48, it describes action tantra for lesser disciples, which involves more external rituals and purification. Then actionless yoga. Then inner yoga. And finally, sitting at the absolute apex of this classification is the Yogini Tantra, which utilizes the inner physiology we've been discussing.
The text describes the result of this ultimate Yogini Tantra with a beautiful metaphor in verses 48 and 49. It speaks of using the churning stick of method and insight. The non-dual awakened mind is churned. From it comes nectar of 24 tastes.
The nectar of 24 tastes. Now, this specific number, 24, is not arbitrary at all. It forms a perfect, seamless bridge between the inner architecture of the yogi that we've been discussing and the external sacred geography of the physical world. Let's explore this sacred geography.
In the Kakrasavara system, the number 24 is central to its sacred geography. The text tells us that there are 24 physical sacred sites spread across the Indian subcontinent and beyond, places with names like Puluramalaya, Jalandhara, Ochiana.
Real physical places.
Yes. In the text, these are abbreviated as syllables, Puru, Jaru, Uru, and so on.
For example, verse 58 lists Puru, very fierce secret Vajra, Jaru, fierce eye, the secret is severed, Oru, the bright one, not pervaded by thought. It goes on to list 24 of these encrypted locations.
According to the lore of the tradition, at these specific physical sites in the world, 24 Echinas were entrusted with profound tantric teachings associated with the inner heat practice. So on one level, the explicit level, this is an external map of pilgrimage sites.
A map for physical travel.
But remember, the hermeneutics we just discussed, we must read deeper. This is a dual map. These 24 geographical sites on the Indian subcontinent correspond exactly to 24 specific channels within the practitioner's own subtle body.
Wow.
The pilgrimage is not just outward across mountains and rivers. It is profoundly inward through the landscape of your own channels.
The body itself is the sacred landscape. But to protect this landscape, the text introduces the concept of seals. Verse 52 says these teachings were sealed with four seals, carefully concealed and carefully disseminated. The four seals are the outer, inner, hidden, and final seals.
And they are strictly enforced.
Right, because then comes a very stern warning in verse 53. If the seals are broken, the sacred vows are corrupted.
A very severe warning.
I have to ask a challenging question here. In our modern information-saturated age, we are deeply suspicious of secrecy. We believe information wants to be free, you know, and that everyone has a right to know everything.
Yes, transparency is the modern ideal.
Exactly. When a modern reader sees an emphasis on secrecy, hidden meanings, and warnings about breaking seals, it often feels like ancient gatekeeping. It feels like an elite institutional club trying to keep the power to themselves. Is there a genuine practical reason for this secrecy? Is there an actual psychological or spiritual danger in approaching these practices casually, or is it just protectionism?
It is a highly valid concern for the modern practitioner, but I invite you to consider it not through the lens of political elitism, but through the lens of advanced physiological science.
Okay.
Let us return to your earlier analogy of the industrial laser. If you have a highly complex schematic for building an immensely powerful laser, you do not publish it openly where a child or someone with no safety training could build it and blind themselves.
You block it up.
The secrecy is not about hoarding the light. It is about respecting the danger of the power. Tinkering with the subtle body's winds, channels, and drops without proper preparation is not a harmless intellectual exercise. Mm-hmm. It has profound, sometimes severe, physiological and psychological effects.
Like breaking a fuse in your own nervous system.
Exactly. If a practitioner tries to force the subtle winds into the central channel without having purified their mind through compassion, without having stabilized their concentration, and without the guidance of someone who has successfully navigated that terrain, the result is often severe psychological destabilization.
What does that look like?
In the Tibetan medical and spiritual traditions, this manifests as deep energetic imbalances, known as lung disorders, which can cause extreme anxiety, physical illness, or even psychosis.
So the seals are essentially safety protocols.
They are entirely about safety. The seals ensure that the practitioner is a fit vessel. The text itself mentions in verse 45 that the types of fit and unfit vessels should also be well analyzed by the guru.
It's the teacher's job to check the vessel.
Yes. The secrecy protects the teachings from being diluted or misunderstood, but more importantly, it protects the unqualified practitioner from harming themselves. The path to breaking the seals is not a secret password. It is years of ethical discipline, foundational practice, and the cultivation of profound, unshakable compassion.
And the key to those seals, the only way to safely navigate this dual map of the inner and outer landscape, is the guru. This brings us to the closing verses of the text. The text implores the listener, in verse 66 and 67, to honor and serve the guru with everything they have, their wealth, their family, their very lives.
It states explicitly in verse 28 that regarding these inner channels and drops, there are mistaken lineages, mistaken placements, and mistaken measurements. There is no attainment from mistakes.
There is no attainment from mistakes.
And again in verse 38, there is no attainment from mistaken causes. You cannot learn this safely from a book. Even a text as profound as Equal to the Sky is ultimately just a map. If you are lost in a dangerous, high-altitude mountain range, a map is largely useless without a living guide who has walked the trails, who knows where the snow bridges are weak, and who can read the changing weather patterns. The living oral instructions of the lineage master are the only things that truly unlock the text. Verse 67 concludes, "One attains realization from the instructions of the guru. Remember to hold them in mind."
As we draw this deep dive to a close, let's take a moment to look back at the immense journey this seemingly short text has taken us on.
We covered a vast amount of ground.
We really did. We started in the boundless, unconditioned space of the awakened mind, the Bhaga. We then met the three Kinis, the sky-dwelling, earth-dwelling, and subterranean Chikinis. Through understanding them as our own internal architecture, we learned how to transmute our ordinary karmic existence.
Step by step.
We learned that the 21,600 breaths we take every day are the physical winds that can be ridden into the central channel. We explored how the inner heat of Kintuli unties the knots of dualism in our 72,000 channels, acting not as a destructive fire of anger, but as a purifying laser of awareness.
The laser, yes.
We witnessed how that heat melts the white drop of awakening mind, bringing our vital essences into a state of ultimate, unchanging bliss, finally free from the turbulent winds of karma that cause us to leak our energy away.
And we learned that to even approach this profound knowledge, we must read with the eyes of a master, understanding the ultimate intent behind the twilight language.
Using those six modes.
Yes. We must approach with a rock-solid foundation of bodhicitta and under the protective, guiding hand of a qualified guru, respecting the seals that keep the profound sacredness of the 24 sites intact.
It is a staggering amount of wisdom compressed into just a few folios. It truly is a galaxy held within a single point of light. And as you step away from this text today, back into the rhythm of your daily life, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Please.
We talked about the 24 sacred sites, those legendary places of power like Puru and Jaru, where the highest teachings are concealed. We often think of pilgrimage as something we must save up for, you know, pack a bag and travel across the oceans to find in a distant land.
An outward journey.
Right. But what if the most profound, mythical, sacred geography is not a place on a map at all? What if the legendary sites where the highest awakening is hidden are entirely contained within the very next breath you take, waiting for you to simply direct the wind of your awareness into the center?
A profound place to begin the real work.
May your winds be peaceful and your awareness clear.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.